War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello and welcome to a very special bonus episode of Key Battles of American History. I'm your host, James Early, as always. Fall 1944, Paris has been liberated, saved from destruction. But this diversion on the road to Berlin has given the Germans time to regroup. The American and British armies press on from the west, facing the enemy time and again in the Hürtgen Forest, during the Market Garden invasion, at the Battle of the Bulge, all while American General George Patton and British Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery vie for supremacy as the Allies' top battlefield commander. Meanwhile, the Soviets begin to squeeze Hitler's crumbling Reich from the east. Led by Generals Georgi Zhukov and Ivan Konev, the Red Army launches millions of soldiers, backed by tanks, artillery, and warplanes, against the Germans, leaving death and scorched earth in their wake, pushing the Wehrmacht back toward their fatherland. As both the Anglo-American Alliance and the Soviets set their sights on claiming the capital city of Nazi Germany, Winston Churchill seeks to ensure Britain's place in a new world divided by Franklin Roosevelt's America and Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union. To discuss this, I have with me best-selling New York Times author Martin Dugard, and he's written many books. He has co-authored the Killing series with Bill O'Reilly, such as Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, and so many others, many of which I've read myself. And he's also, in his own right, written several books, including Taking Paris, Into Africa, and The Explorers. But today we're going to discuss his book, Taking Berlin, The Bloody Race to Defeat the Third Reich. Martin, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, James, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, too. It's an honor to have an author who's sold as many books as you have. So this is great. I'm looking forward to discussing this. I enjoyed the book very much, and there's so much to discuss. We could easily spend 2 or 3 hours, but we're going to focus on just some of the high points here. So without any further ado, let's get started. In fact, I'm going to start at the very beginning. I was intrigued by your introduction. You started out the book by discussing a now famous speech made by General George Patton on May 31st, 1944. What does this speech tell us about Patton's character and his style of leadership, Martin?
Well, you know, the reason for using it that early is for that exact reason, to set up Patton's character. And he had given a speech very similar to that throughout England to Allied troops who were going to be, you know, like soon landing on the D-Day beaches. But, you know, it's everything he says, everything, you know, the posture, he's driven in on a, you know, motorcade, like a, almost like a Roman, you know, emperor. And he steps up the speech, he's got this swagger about him, and the things he says to the soldiers are things that nobody says. You know, at the time, you know, you had barracks language, but you never heard an officer say that publicly. But all of a sudden you had Patton getting up there, swearing in front of the troops, you know, treating them like equals, even though he was the commanding officer, but, you know, making that clear at the same time. And I love that speech because, you know, they used it in the movie Patton, but they had to trim it down for time. But to imagine being one of the soldiers who, you're a young man, you're, you know, early 20s, you're about to go into this big invasion, you don't know what's going to happen next, and this man is coming along to pump you up and to get you to do things you don't think is possible, must have been incredibly motivating.
Yeah, it really did pump him up too, didn't it?
It did.
When I was reading that, of course, all I could think of in my mind was that famous scene at the beginning of the movie, which I'd actually just recently rewatched. But yeah, it's incredible the power he had to inspire people. And we'll talk more about Patton a little bit later. But I want to, moving ahead to the D-Day invasion, Operation Overlord, a lot of people don't know that in addition to Operation Overlord, there was another operation. And I won't say anything about it, so I can let you describe it. But I find this one fascinating, and it's Operation Fortitude. What was Operation Fortitude, Martin? And in your opinion, do you think it was effective?
Yeah, so Operation Fortitude was, you know, everybody knew that Patton was the best commander in World War II on either side of the, well, let's say on the American side of the war. You know, Rommel was arguably better, and the Soviets had their own people. But it was just an act of deception. You know, Patton had gotten in the doghouse with Eisenhower, and they spent a lot of time, you know, trying to convince the Germans that the attack wasn't going to place at, you know, it was going to come to Calais, straight across the Straits of Dover, which is the shortest possible way to get across. So, you know, in the fields and meadows of southern England, you had, you know, inflatable dummy tanks. You had, you know, people marching who had no intention of going to the war. And they kept Patton a secret. The whole idea was to keep Patton from, you know, disclosing that he was part of the invasion. And the Germans bought it. You know, Hitler, you know, as much as Rommel was trying to get, when he, once the invasion took place, was trying to get Hitler to release the 15th Panzer Division to come south and defend Normandy, Hitler still believed that Patton was the true general in charge of the thing. And then if he did that, they were going to storm across from Calais into Calais. It made a big difference.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite. I love the deception and espionage and things like that, along with Operation Mincemeat. Operation Fortitude is one of my favorite stories of World War II. I just love that, you know, the rubber tanks and the fake airplanes and the fake radio dispatches and all that. It's great. When I teach on World War II, I show my students a photo of like six guys picking up one of the rubber tanks, and my students go, how in the world did six guys pick up a tank? Because it's made out of rubber. Yeah, all right. Well, that was an amazing thing. And as you said, I agree with you totally that it really helped make Operation Overlord a success. Now, let's land on the beaches with the guys, and now they're trying to break out. So I want to talk about the closing of the Falaise Gap. That's an interesting story and a critical operation. And if you wouldn't mind, maybe you could focus on the actions of Sergeant Bud Hawk. You write about him. You write a lot about a lot of individual soldiers, sometimes enlisted men, sometimes officers, sometimes generals, but I found this one especially interesting.
Well, I chose Bud Hawk because, first of all, he's part of the Third Army. He won the Medal of Honor. But, you know, the Falaise Pocket, the Falaise Gap was one of those, unless you really are a geek about World War II history, it's one of those moments that, you know, you just don't know about. So, you know, what happens is, you know, the Americans come off the Normandy beaches. We finally start moving inland. You know, the British are kind of starting to move inland, you know, especially they're finally, Montgomery's finally starting to take Cannes. And, but we finally have the Germans encircled. When you think about this, think about a noose. Within it are, you know, 100,000 German soldiers and their tanks and their weapons. And if we can close that noose, the war isn't over, but at the same time, these people aren't able to escape to fight another day. And Bud Hawk was one of those people who, when that day came in August of 1944, was able to, you know, stand and fight and try to hold back the German onslaught, almost like a one-man army, just because it was such a pivotal cinch point that when he was standing there, you know, fighting back, and he's getting shot up by, you know, Panzer tanks, and, you know, he's directing traffic between, you know, U.S. tank destroyers, inciting them on to where the Panzers are located. It was an amazing moment. And then, you know, throughout the whole thing, one of the reasons he gets the Medal of Honor is that he doesn't just, you know, direct fire, but he takes part in fire. He gets hit, you know, survives this horrific thing where he should have been shot down a dozen times. And it's just one of those random, I love it because it's one of those random moments in history where one individual makes a complete difference. Because, you know, we didn't close that noose entirely, and a lot of Germans escaped. A lot of the Nazi army lived to fight another day, but just enough people, you know, were held back because of his actions that he effectively ended the war for a large part of Hitler's army.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 100,000 guys is a significant force, even if it's not the whole Wehrmacht. Yeah, that's incredible. Great story. All right, let's go back to Patton again. And so, famously, General George Patton and Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, one of the British senior commanders, they had this relationship that today we might call frenemies. You know, they were, as you know, they were rivals. They were pleasant to each other. They respected each other, but they also seemed to always want to one-up the other. So will you discuss the rivalry between them, and how did it affect the Allied advance toward Germany?
Well, you know, you have two things. So you have the rivalry between the British, who had fought in the war since 1939. You know, your war was declared September 3, 1939, at 11:15 in the morning in London by Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. And the British fought alone against the Germans after the fall of France until December 7th, 1941. That's 2 years. I mean, more than 2 years. So the British felt very much like they were on their own. The U.S. wasn't helping them. We finally came in because of Pearl Harbor. And so, you know, Patton kind of enters the scene in 1942 when we're North Africa. Montgomery is also in North Africa and trying to defeat Rommel. Patton is trying to defeat Rommel, you know, the Germans' top, you know, tank commander. And it's really interesting because all of a sudden it goes from Montgomery, who's, you know, basically elevated to, you know, the commander of the British troops in the desert just before the Battle of El Alamein, which is where he defeated Rommel, to, you know, Patton never having that chance to fight Rommel toe to toe and have the big grand tank battle. And then they go, and then that same rivalry between Patton and Montgomery is transferred to, you know, the invasion of Sicily, where they race to get to Palermo, which is the capital, and Patton, you know, miraculously, through much more rugged terrain, beats Montgomery there, which really peeved Montgomery. Patton steps on his own toes by, you know, slapping a soldier and getting sidelined. But when Patton is finally called into the war, the landings in Europe in, you know, late August, early September 1944, his greatest rival is Montgomery, because, you know, you have to bear in mind that these are two men who have trained their whole professional lives in their, you know, mid-50s, late-50s, early-60s, you know, Patton's not yet 60. They've trained their whole professional lives for this battle, for this moment, and they want the glory of being the first guy to lead their troops into Berlin. So you have the British population, there's the rivalry there, where the British population wants Montgomery to be the guy and Churchill's behind him. But then you've got, you know, Patton trying to be the guy, and he's a different kind of general. He's a maverick. He just goes straight forward. He doesn't worry about, you know, supplies. He just attacks, whereas Montgomery is a big set-piece general. And then you have the politics that ensue where, you know, General Dwight Eisenhower is trying to make sure the British are happy and the Americans are happy at the same time. And you get this rivalry between Patton and Montgomery that, you know, I've got a friend who's a great Patton expert, and he tells me that the two were likely more friendly than we think, but at the same time, they're kind of frosty when it came to who was going to command more of the troops in battle.
Yeah, these are two very talented men, but these are not humble men.
I don't think you can be a humble man if you are, you know, commanding entire armies like that. You have to, if you're a humble man, you're not going to be a great commander. You have to have a bit of audacity and panache. And, you know, Patton is tall, you know, kind of boldly aggressive. You know, he competed in the 1912 Olympics in the modern pentathlon. Instead of using the target gun, he used his actual revolver. You know, he's that kind of guy. Whereas Montgomery, much more British. He was much more health conscious. He was thin. He was very, you know, kind of hard to be around because he'd be very persnickety. But the two of them, if you don't have that ego, and we saw that with a lot of generals in World War II, men who were raised to that level, but when push came to shove, they couldn't make the hard decisions. That's what differentiates even those people from Montgomery and Patton.
Man, that's a good, excellent point. Yeah. So you mentioned Eisenhower in passing, and so I want to piggyback on that. In fact, that leads into my next question. Can you comment upon Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander? What strengths did he bring to the table?
Yeah, it's interesting to note that, you know, Eisenhower never commanded men in battle, you know, as a field commander. He was always, you know, he was a bureaucrat, he was a logistical guy, but at the same time, he had the gift of combining all that stuff. You know, he worked for MacArthur for a long time, so he knew what it was like to work for a big ego, and he also knew how to corral those big egos. So what I love about Eisenhower is the thing that also frustrates a lot of people at Eisenhower is he's a diplomat. His job is not to make sure that that Patton gets deference, you know, gets preference over Montgomery, or that Montgomery gets preference over Patton. He's trying to make sure that everybody gets their place at the table so that when the war is over, the British feel like they've been accommodated, the Americans feel like they've been accommodated. At the end, we'll talk about this later, he makes sure the Russians feel accommodated. And it's a singular strength, then it doesn't apply to most command positions. But when it comes to World War II and the 1944-1945 land battle in Europe, you needed a diplomat. You needed someone who could set aside his own ego to make sure that everybody was placated and everybody was ready to go in action, knowing that he was behind them. And as long as they succeeded, he was going to continue to be behind them.
All right. So let's change gears a little bit here. You mentioned in a couple of your chapters the V2 rockets. So if you wouldn't mind, for the listeners that may not even know what a V2 rocket is, can you just kind of explain briefly what they are? And then I'd like to hear your take on their effect on British morale and on the war in general. Like, did they make a huge difference, or what exactly did they accomplish for the Germans? So V2.
Well, you kind of got to go, we got to go deep into the weeds here, James.
So no problem.
Let's go back. So you go back to the Battle of Britain, which I'm writing about right now with the third book in the series, which is taking London, and you have the Spitfire, the Hurricane, fighting off the British as they try to, you know, bomb London, bomb the English countryside. And then you have the London Blitz, the Blitz of, 1940, 1941. But when it becomes clear to Hitler that he cannot tactically destroy England with aircraft, he goes to the V1 bomber, which is the first edition of this. But the V1 is pretty much the World War II equivalent of a drone. But instead of a drone that fires a missile, it's a drone that just lands into something and blows things up. It was effective, but only to a certain point. The V2, however, was a rocket. It was something that they launched from bases in Belgium, you know, just across the channel. And its sole job was it had a gyroscope in the nose. It had a ton of, you know, explosive in the nose. It went straight up in the air in an arc. And it was, you know, guided down onto a target. And it's the same thing as if you had if you were launching a rocket from, I don't know, let's say Denver to New York. It was that kind of thing where all of a sudden you'd have rockets falling on New York. And they were extremely effective. I mean, when they landed, they put craters on the earth. They didn't just blow up a building or, you know, strike a truck. They blew stuff up. And the British by that time in the war were, you know, 1944, they've been at war for 5 years. They were extremely resilient, but at the same time, this was a whole new kind of warfare. And these are the same people that eventually, the people who designed this were the same people who eventually put American rockets into space and put men on the moon. But at the time, that they were determined to destroy Britain, and it was extremely effective.
All right, that's great. So now we're moving forward into the fall of 1944. The old famous Allied setback or disaster, if you want to call it that, Operation Market Garden. It seemed so promising in some ways, and yet it just didn't work out. So tell us a little bit about Operation Market Garden. And in particular, I'd love to hear General James Gavin's role in the effort. Jumpin' Jim Gavin is one of the characters that you mention a lot throughout the book and very interesting person. And if you want, you can talk about his background first, and then you can go to the battle, just whatever you want to do. But I'd love to hear about both the battle and General Gavin in particular.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Well, sure. You know, James Gavin was 37. He was already, you know, inexplicably had risen to the level of two-star general at such a young age. You know, he did so by switching into the paratroops in a time when it was an up-and-coming, you know, I wouldn't say a branch of the service because it wasn't, but it was just a new discipline. Just like Patton in 1940 moved into tanks from cavalry, Gavin did the same thing by moving into parachutes. And what I love about Gavin, he's young, he's a stud, he is a leader who leads from the front. He's an amazing man. He's very, very smart. He's very organized, compassionate towards his men. You know, but the thing about Market Garden, and I went into the book thinking it was a failure and I've been to many of the war museums throughout Europe that do a little bit about Market Garden, and it did fail. But at the same time, it was a very bold attempt by Montgomery, you know, to cross the Rhine, and it really came close to succeeding. I won't go into the number of things that he could have done differently to make sure it succeeded, but the bottom line is they tried to take British and American troops. You know, actually, let's differentiate. British troops who were going to be on the Belgian border, they were going to get on this two-lane country road and drive, you know, all these people, you know, all these tanks and all these men were going to drive 65 miles behind enemy lines. And the way that this was going to be successful is because it takes place in the Netherlands, you know, Holland, which is flat, which is, you know, has divided by rivers and a number of bridges. And the way that, this was going to work was that British and American paratroopers were going to land on these bridges, capture these bridges, and make sure that they did not get blown up so that the British armor could go straight through Holland and then right on into Germany. And where things got hung up was, and they, even on the planning phase, they could tell that what, you know, Robert Boyd Browning, one of the British generals, is thought to have said, you know, I think it's a bridge too far, just one too many bridges. And that's the bridge at Arnhem, which is the one that takes people across the Rhine. But what I love about that attack, if you drive that route, it's a back road. It is not, we're not talking about a highway through Holland. It is not a straight shot. It twists and turns. It goes past farms and windmills. And, but against all odds, you know, Gavin, you know, plus, you know, and the 82nd Airborne plus the 101st Airborne captured the bridges they were supposed to take. The British people captured the bridge in Arnhem they were supposed to take. Problem was that the British tanks only got as far as Nijmegen, which is the bridge before Arnhem, which is 10 miles away, which is the bridge too far. So you had all these British paratroopers and Polish paratroopers stuck in Arnhem. They took the bridge, but they were cut off, and out of 10,000 men, 2,500 perished. The good news is, though, that the, you know, Gavin and the U.S. troops that captured the Nijmegen Bridge held that bridge, and he was there for a while, and that's where he meets Martha Gellhorn, who's Ernest Hemingway's third wife, who is there as a reporter. You know, it's just kind of this wonderful thing where they've done the impossible, but at the same time, it has made no difference whatsoever.
Yeah, so you mentioned Martha Gellhorn. She's also someone that keeps popping up in the book, so why don't you tell us a little about Martha Gellhorn, and then you, maybe her involvement with General Gavin a little bit later. She's a fascinating character.
Yeah, you know, so when I began writing the book, I wanted to put Ernest Hemingway in there because he's a character in Taking Paris, which is the prequel to this book. And it talks about the fall of Paris. You know, Hemingway famously worked with the French Resistance. He liberated the Ritz Bar in Paris. And I thought Hemingway would be a great character for Taking Berlin, just follow his path. But after Paris, you know, Hemingway really doesn't do a lot except sleep around and get drunk and appear on the battlefield and kind of write not great stuff, you know, from a journalistic point of view. Whereas Martha Gellhorn, his wife, who had done all these amazing things, like she stowed away at a hospital ship to the coast to be part of the D-Day landings. You know, she's at Market Garden. She's in Italy, you know, watching the war over there. She does all these things. She flies on a bomber. She's crazy brave, very attractive woman, very beautiful. You can see why Hemingway would have been attracted to such a, you know, an adventurous spirit. And it's weird because she writes such great prose during this time. And that's why she replaced Hemingway in the narrative for me, is because Hemingway disappears after the Battle of the Bulge, you know, right around New Year's Day, 1945, whereas Gellhorn goes right through the end of the war all the way to Dachau, the liberation of the camps. And she's a very, very strong woman who at the same time is a fantastic writer, and to see her words and try to help them rise above the page so we could, you know, tell, so I could tell a story that, you know, I kind of felt like I was there along with her. And then of course she meets and falls in love with James Gavin and they have a torrid affair, which doesn't hurt the narrative at all because they were both the same age. They were both very adventurous people, like I said about both of them. And when they fell in love, it was a very compassionate, very tempestuous romance that becomes something that I like finding that because very few people, it's been written about, but not in any depth. And I was able to even get a copy of Gavin's own journals, which had never been before published, and use some of the dates and some of his observations about her in the book, which made me feel like I was kind of a fly on the wall watching the two of them just kind of circle each other and find a way to be happy in the middle of all that war.
Yeah, it really is interesting. It gives a lot of drama and a lot of human interest. So the book is not just this battle, that battle. You know, I love the way you introduce so many people, you know, just characters, human beings, and you talked about them as human beings rather than just as military commanders. Of course, Gellhorn wasn't in the military at all, but she did a wonderful job of staying close to the military and getting in there, getting the story written.
Now, I was going to say, what I like about Gellhorn she was not a camp follower. I mean, she was a dedicated journalist and professional. And even though she and Gavin have this romance, there were moments where they had such heated arguments about some of his tactics and some of the ways that, you know, that men were traded and, you know, a lot of people died that she didn't think she could have died, that at one point had her placed under arrest because he was afraid she was going to storm out and find her way and be captured by the Germans. It was that kind of hot affair.
Yeah, it's just not an affair if you don't have the other person arrested at some point. Wow.
Sure.
That's
I like funny. It. I like that. That's good.
Yeah, that'd be, you can use that. That's fine in your next book. Anyway, so we've been talking exclusively so far about the what's going on in Western Europe and the Western Allies' drive toward Berlin. But you also, in your book, of course, devote some time to the Russian effort. And of course, the Russians carried the lion's share. They did the bulk of the fighting against the Germans, and they lost far more men than did the British or the Americans. So let's talk a little bit about them. One of the things that I find interesting, if a little bit gruesome and tragic, is how did Russian soldiers treat German civilians as they advanced toward Berlin? And if you want, not just German, but I know that Polish and other civilians, how did they deal with them as they were moving closer and closer to Berlin?
That's a delicate question just because of what's going on in the Ukraine right now, because it's very...
Yeah.
But I'll say this, that when the Germans, you know, drove through Poland and tried to capture Moscow, they were relentless in their destruction of anything Russian. They locked people in churches and burned them down. They raped women. They shot children, all the same stuff that after the Russians turned things around and began driving back towards Berlin, that the Russians did to the Germans. So, and what's interesting to note about that is that both sides, you know, it's, you know, the rivalry between those cultures is not, you know, just 1940 to 1945. You know, it went back centuries. The Rus, R-U-S, which was short for Russian, were a tribe of, you know, that the Vikings discovered in the 8th century. And they were known for being completely barbaric. So this is not a new thing. But, you know, for instance, when the Germans captured Paris, they didn't rape women. They didn't, you know, bomb the city to oblivion. They tried to keep it as just a normal place where people could walk out and do their daily life. You know, contrast that with what went on in Moscow, in Stalingrad and Leningrad, where everybody was just trying to kill each other. And it was just a different kind of warfare. It was ruthless to the point of the kind of brutality that I think you and I both, we hope never to see in our own lives, because it was pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's really tough to read about. I remember the first time I read about the Eastern Front, I was just shocked at how totally brutal and ugly it was. You know, I mean, you think about the war in the West, the Allies, the Western Allies versus the Germans. I mean, it wasn't pretty, but it wasn't, as you implied, it wasn't anything like what was going on between the Russians and Germans. I mean, they weren't content just to kill their enemy. They wanted to starve them, torture them, rape, mutilate, just do every ugly, horrible thing in the book. And you're right, it goes back several centuries. I think about the Teutonic Knights and how they invaded Russia back in the Middle Ages. And it's, oh yeah, it's just, but you did a good job of discussing that, I thought. And anyway, we'll talk more about the Russians a little bit later, but I want to again change gears now. And I want to talk about some, at least somewhat unsung heroes. I don't think the average American knows about them at all. And probably even the average American who considers themselves a World War II buff might not know tons about them. Tell me about the 100th Infantry Battalion. What's special about them and what kind of things did they accomplish? I know a lot of their fighting was in Italy, but I'll let you tell the rest of the story.
Well, I mean, what's unique about them is that there was so much animosity towards Japanese Americans and anybody who looked remotely like a Japanese American, you know, including Hawaiians, after Pearl Harbor. And the fact that these young men, you know, volunteered to join the military and were literally sent off to wage war in Europe because they weren't trusted to wage war in the Pacific is really interesting as far as just the level of their courage. And I don't do it justice in the book, and I'll be right up front about that because it's a book unto itself. But, you know, the number of lives lost by them as they, you know, as they rescued the Texas Lost Battalion you know, in the forests of, in mountains of France, was their courage was superlative. I mean, these are men who were, you know, as they traveled into combat, as they trained and, you know, went through places like Mississippi and the Deep South on their way in towards Europe, were treated as second-class citizens. And then for them to go into combat and show incredible courage and incredible determination to help people that had once spit upon them was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, and weren't they the most decorated unit in the entire war for the Americans?
I put an asterisk next to that because a lot of that came after the war.
But okay.
Having said that, you know, a decoration, you know, Medal of Honor is Medal of Honor. And you could also argue the fact that they didn't get those Medals of Honor during the war because of a lot of discrimination against them. But what they did was, you know, and the conditions, you know, it's raining, it's snowing, it's cold, it's gray. There's no artillery, there's no tanks, there's nothing to relieve them. They are stuck and they are pinned down and they are surrounded and they found a way. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and weren't some of their parents being held in the internment camps? I think I remember reading that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
It's remarkable. I mean, and you think about it, if my parents were in that kind of situation, I might find myself a little bit, I don't know how it would feel, you know, because, but yeah. How do you balance the fact that your parents are being held in an internment camp? And I've been to a number of them, and they're not in places that any of us would want to spend a summer or a winter. And then, yet you still go like a true patriot and go fight to defend your country. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible. I can't say anything else. There's an amazing group of people. Okay, switching now to back to the West, and we're going to move into December of 1944. Let's talk about the Battle of the Bulge. Can you just give me a brief overview of that, and how much did it set back the Allied war effort?
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Well, you got to remember the battle. Germany was supposed to be defeated after Paris. When Paris fell on August 26, 1944, there was a lot of talk about, like, we'll be home for Christmas, Germany's about to fall. What people didn't realize is that once Germans started defending Germany, it was a different war. And then all along, you know, a lot of generals have been trying to encourage Adolf Hitler to sue for peace. And the only way he could think of to sue for peace was to drive a wedge between Montgomery's army in the north and Patton's army in the south, what's called a salient, S-A-L-I-E-N-T, military thinking, which is basically just driving a big wedge between, you know, the opposing forces, which is where we get the term bulge. So the Battle of the Bulge was just a big salient where Hitler was trying to drive German troops all the way back through the line, you know, the Allied lines to take the port cities of Northern Europe so that once he held them, he could defend them with a limited number of troops and be able to go back and say, you know, let's have a surrender. You know, we'll keep Germany, you keep these places. And who knows what would have happened if it would have, you know, succeeded, but it did not succeed, but it was total surprise. You know, December 16th, 1944, you have, you know, German guns opening up before dawn. Americans who, all the American troops in the area that were fired upon in the Ardennes Forest were getting recovery and treatment after, you know, horrific losses in other parts of the battlefield. So these are people who are supposed to be getting a rest, and instead they're getting fired upon. And soon enough, the Germans came through. They took these men prisoner. They took their coats because it was the coldest winter people could remember. And then they kept on pushing through. They committed atrocities. You know, there was one German group that, you know, killed and, you know, slaughtered with machine guns, you know, American, you know, Allied prisoners. It was horrific. And then in the middle of all this, you know, George S. Patton's intelligence chief had told him that he thought this was happening. He picked up radio chatter. He just thought the Germans were going to do something. But he had warned Patton ahead of time, if they do this, we can pivot, we can go due north, and we can, you know, kind of help alleviate whatever, you know, stuff that the Germans are doing. And that's exactly what happened. You know, Patton went to before Eisenhower, a group of Allied generals, and said, I can move my third army. We're not going to attack deeper into Germany. We're going to pivot. We're going to go up to Bastogne, and we're going to relieve the forces up there. We're going to stop the German advance. And that's exactly what happened.
Okie doke. Well, now let's move forward a little bit more and let's talk some politics now. What happened at the Yalta Conference, and what were the long-term effects on world history? Very monumental things happened there. So tell us about that.
Well, I like to think that everything that happened between the Yalta Conference and today is connected. So, you know, I mean, you look at the stuff going on in the Ukraine, you know, the rivalry for many years between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and the rivalry, you know, the slow diminishment of the British government, and then they come back to life with the help of the United States. A lot of that, you know, everything that's happening, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Cold War, all that stuff, we can trace that to the Yalta Conference, where the world is essentially divided by three men, and they make plans for a post-war world. So what happens after we are comfortably ashore after D-Day is that the focus of the world is not, it shifts from just making landfall in France. It becomes more about how are we going to divide the war after the war is over. And that's exactly what happens. And you have, you know, Stalin is, you know, is held in the Soviet republics. So, you know, he bugs everybody's, every allied person's room. Who knows exactly what they're going to be trying for. You know, Roosevelt is dying. He's 63. His arteries are completely hardened. He's seen smoke. He has cigarette. He's the youngest man of the three leaders, you know, Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt. But he, at the same time, his face is gray. You can tell he only has a few more months to live, and he does. And, you know, Churchill's just trying to hang on because Britain is impoverished at this point. They've fought this war for so long. So it's a foreshadowing of what the world would look like after the war, which leads to Churchill's 1946, you know, Iron Curtain speech in Missouri, which leads to, you know, Harry Truman dropping the bomb on Japan, which leads to everything that happens before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then the rekindling of the Soviet Union right now in an idea, in an attempt to bring all that back to the former Soviet, you know, domination of the part of Europe and Eurasia.
Okay, one more question. And this is, we're going to bring in the Soviets again. This is an interesting thing. Sometimes I get asked this. Why did the Allies allow the Soviets to take Berlin while they, that is the Allies, held back? I know you mentioned in the book there was an operation even to parachute people into, you know, Western Allied soldiers into Berlin, and then that got pulled. Tell us about that.
Well, the war, what happened was there was a division of Berlin that took place before that between the Allied powers. And so the idea was that, you know, this is Eisenhower talking, like, why are we going to risk American lives to drive these extra miles into Berlin to encounter all this fighting? You know, the estimate was 100,000 lives. If we're going to just give it back to the Soviets after the war is over and divide it into, you know, a Soviet sector, an American sector, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Patton is told about this in, I think, March or April 1945, and he's despondent. He thinks that, and rightly so, thinks we're making the worst decision we can make. So Eisenhower says, we're going to stop at the Elbe River. We're going to let the Soviets take Berlin, which they do, and they rape and kill everything in sight. Meanwhile, Montgomery stops because Montgomery is just glad to be where he is on May 7th, 1945, when he accepts the German surrender. But Patton keeps going. Patton is so angry that he decides, his whole thing is like, we either fight the Soviets now or we fight them later. And he goes all the way into Czechoslovakia. And it's one of those things where Eisenhower finally has to say, you got to stop. You got to come back. And only later does everyone realize that Patton had the right idea. You know, that the Soviets were supposed to, you know, they entered Bulgaria, Poland, Romania, Yugoslavia, Hungary, and they were supposed to give all those territories back, but instead they used them as Warsaw Pact countries and buffer states throughout the Soviet Union to make sure that nobody attacked them. So it was a time in the world where Americans trusted Soviets in a time when they should not have trusted the Soviets. So it was just a huge error that eventually cost a lot of people years of freedom and in many aspects of their lives.
Yeah, if only they had hindsight, of course they couldn't have had that. But I think Roosevelt trusted the Soviets even more, Truman a little bit less, but Truman was still pretty new on the job. And I guess he just didn't feel in a position to make any major command decisions. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, two things, you know, two different questions. I think that Roosevelt, for some reason, chose to trust Stalin just based on strength, even though we had propped up his government with the Lend-Lease Act. And, you know, Stalin was as duplicitous as they come. He was the kind of guy who made sure that all the curtains in his home only never reached the floor because he wanted to make sure that nobody was hiding behind the curtain to kill him. And so, yeah, but, you know, Roosevelt, this guy who was so completely political and so completely in tune with politics, for some reason, trusted Stalin as if Stalin was an upstanding guy. And then you have the Truman issue. Ian Truman was no dummy. He's kind of played as like this hillbilly because he just came in. But, you know, he had fought World War One. He was an artillery commander in World War One. He knew how to wage war. He understood people. But at the same time, you come in as the new president after Franklin Roosevelt's been president for 12 years, almost 13 years. And, you know, he wasn't prepared for that. He just thought he was going to be vice president. And so he learned on the job. And so the decisions he made in May 1945 were decisions that he would not have made later, which is inevitably why he made the hard decision to drop the atomic bombs in August and September 1945.
Very good. Well, that was my last question. I tell you, folks, listeners, you got to read this book. It's a very entertaining book as well. It's informative. I've read many books about World War II, and I still learn quite a few things. Great characters, the way Martin, as I said earlier, humanizes them. So the name of the book, once again, is Taking Berlin, The Bloody Race to Defeat the Third Reich. Martin, thank you so much for coming onto the show. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Oh, James, it's been fantastic. Seriously, fantastic. Thanks for letting me talk because I'm a history nerd, so I love the chance to talk about history. So
maybe it's a perfect podcast for you to be on. So we'll have to do it again. Maybe when you finish taking London, or maybe we'll go back and do Paris eventually. So that would be a lot of fun. So
yeah, read Paris. Paris is a great book. It's a lot of fun.
I will do that. All right. Well, thank you so much. And listeners, we'll see you next time on Key Battles of American History.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several great podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, and Vlogging Through History by Chris Mowry. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Colonels Lee Beaumont, Terry Davis, and Josh Simpson, Majors Chris C., Alex Calabres, Carlos Calderon, Anna Concepcion Castro, Brandon Cuckler, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, Jay Robison, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Robbie Edwards, Eli Forsyth, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Mike Leslie, Billy Malone, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Ryan Ramones, David Santee, Michael Severino, Jeff Vandermeulen, and Gregory Works. And lieutenants, Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Scott Hendricks, Who's Your Daddy, David Lueza, Eugene Rosso, Jeff Sabo, and Lawrence Welk. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.